John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our political discussion continues this afternoon. We're going to take a slightly different focus. We just spent an hour talking about the Iowa caucus, which takes place tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about the demographics of the Republican voting base. And what caught our eye was an NPR report recently with a headline, Republicans, white workers, and white working class voters, is it a trap? The reporter Asma Cully joins us this hour to discuss the story and the GOP's growing reliance on white working class voters. She's been following the campaigns of several Republican presidential candidates and reporting about the size of the GOP tent and whether the door inside will get wider and more inclusive. Asma Khalid, thanks for joining me. I know you don't have a lot of time to spend with us, so let's get right to it. Talk a little bit about your story and what you found when you started looking at the issue of who the Republican base is.
Sure, happy to, John. So we essentially had heard a lot about sort of who makes up the coalition of Donald Trump in particular, Donald Trump's support. And a number of the polls so far this election season have suggested that Donald Trump is relying heavily on white working class voters. That's not to say that that's where he gets, you know, the full support of his. I mean, he is pulling from a vast variety of supporters across educational backgrounds. But if you look through the crosstabs of a lot of polls, what you'll see is that while he may win, sort of college-educated voters or even voters with postgrad degrees, you know, he may do well amongst that group, he does extremely well among white working-class voters, so much better than all the other candidates in that group that that's kind of what bumps him up and gives him the edge collectively, if, you know, you sort of parse out all of that data. And so that's where the question began. We wanted to sort of understand, given his support amongst this base, what does that mean for the Republican Party writ large? And the educational anatomy of the Republican Party look like today, particularly if we were to sort of do this long view and look at what the Republican Party of today looks like, say, compared to the Republican Party of Reagan.
Let's talk about that, because there's a pretty stark difference in the demographics of voters between 1980 and 2012. And I guess that was the thing that really caught my attention when I originally looked at your article. There's a pretty startling graph there. Talk about the difference in the electorate now between now and 1980.
Sure. Well, in 1980, 65% of all voters were white working class voters, and so that means two things. I mean, that means that the electorate was, you know, white overwhelmingly, but also that majority of folks did not have a college degree. Jump ahead more than three decades, and we looked at 2012 exit polls. This was the year that Mitt Romney was defeated by President Obama. And in that year, the size of the electorate that was white working class had shrunk to 36% of all voters. So, I mean, essentially it had been halved in about 30 years. And that's, you know, twofold. One is that the electorate overall has become more diverse. But secondly, it's also that the electorate, by and large, is far more educated than it was 30-some years ago. And so we wanted to sort of look specifically at the white population and get a better understanding of where, educationally, we've seen a divide amongst party allegiance. And that's what led us to this sort of big overarching analysis that finds that, yes, you know, the share of the electorate that is white working class has shrunk, but if you look at the way that the Republican candidates have relied on that population over time, in some ways you could argue that they have actually become increasingly Republican, that block of voters, that they were more evenly divided in the 1980 election between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter than they are today. They are today overwhelmingly, more than likely, expected to vote Republican.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the Kathleen Dunn Show this afternoon. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and you can also reach us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. So Trump's popularity is a result of, at least in part, of his enormous popularity among white working class voters. How does this break along gender lines?
You know, I don't know so much about gender lines. I know that we've heard by and large that men tend to vote more in sync with the Republican Party than women do. That does tend to hold true across the board. Some of the groups that I looked at beyond college degree, we also looked at the post-grad education, post-grad electorate, and that's something that hasn't been tracked for as many years. But if you were to look at post-grad women, they are one of the most consistently Democratic-leaning groups.
But what about differences in education? I guess we were talking, you know, the difference between the electorate today. One of the differences is it's a lot more educated. Just how strong is Donald Trump among those aspects of the demographic groups that have advanced degrees, and particularly graduate degrees?
So I guess that's hard to say. I mean, there's been so many polls put out collectively. I cover New Hampshire quite a bit, and New Hampshire is a fairly educated state. Here in New Hampshire, you know, if you look at how he does amongst that population, he has led a number of polls. When you look at education levels, usually sort of divvied out by people with a college degree or higher, or people who do not have a college degree, and he still receives more support. I guess it depends on what particular poll you're looking at, but say the margin is maybe 5 points in Donald Trump's favor, you're looking at, you know, leads that are, say, sort of three times that when you look at the white non-college population. And so I think the argument is not that Donald Trump isn't winning a variety of groups. It's more that he's just winning so overwhelmingly, or sorry, I shouldn't say winning, but at this point seems to be having an advantage so overwhelmingly amongst folks who do not have a college degree.
Is it sustainable for the Republican Party to continue to rely on white working class voters in national contests?
Yeah, you know, John, that's a tricky thing, because I think, you know, we looked at both the percentage of the Republican primary electorate in Iowa and New Hampshire. You know, these are two of the early nominating states, and white working class voters, you know, are still really a bedrock of the GOP in those two states. They made up nearly half of all Republican voters in both the 2012 Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. And so with that, you know, you take in mind that it's very hard then to win a Republican primary in either one of these early nominating states without doing very, very well amongst the white non-college population. But if you sort of extrapolate that and take it further, in a general election context, it becomes increasingly difficult to rely on that population to win a general election contest.
Well, and it seems like, you know, the traditional wisdom was that you ran to the right or the left, depending on which party you were trying to capture the nomination of during the primary season. And then you could run back to the center again for the general election. But it really seems like the divide between the two parties is so great now that it seems like it would be pretty tough to try to run back to the middle after the primaries. Is that something that that is reflected in is caused by our shift in demographics over the last 30 years?
You know, that's a really good question about partisanship. I think, John, right, in terms of people just sort of becoming more entrenched on one side or the other. And the data that we collected, we worked with the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. They have looked at some of the ideas of people becoming sort of more ideologically driven, sort of identifying more as conservative or liberal over the years. And that is something that they have seen also increased over the last 30 years. And so whether or not people will be able, or candidates can sort of run to the right or the left, as you said, and then sort of rejigger and reposition themselves for a general election, I don't know. I mean, I think that sort of time will tell if that'll be possible in this election cycle. I think, you know, one thing I should say is that we relied on data in 2012. You know, and in that election, President Obama did very, very well amongst both postgraduates as well as various minority groups. I think one thing I should say is that when you do look at the white college population, Mitt Romney won that group and won it rather, you know, well. And so I think to some degree, it'll be interesting to see the degree to which any Republican candidate is able to consistently win the white college population. Because while we sort of focus on people who have advanced degrees and say that, yes, they are leaning more towards the Democratic Party, they're still a fairly small chunk of the electorate.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join our conversation this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show. 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the one that you're used to using for this program. The Facebook address still the same. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. So, have we heard from GOP Party Chairman Rince Priebus about the party's reliance on white working class voters? Do we get any kind of sense from party leaders that they need to expand their tent? I mean, they went through all this soul searching supposedly after the 2012 election, and you know, we need to expand our voter base, and we need to do more. But when you look at the rhetoric in the campaign for the Iowa caucus, I wonder if we're seeing that or not. Are you hearing that from Republican insiders that this is a problem they need to address?
I mean, I think you, John, sort of touched on that with the idea that after the 2012 defeat of Mitt Romney, that there was a lot of soul searching within the Republican Party. And, you know, there was this, you could call it an autopsy, right, released where there was sort of an appraisal of how the party did. And there was a sort of a very conscious effort laid out that the party needs to try to attract a number of minorities. In terms of the educational diversity, I will say I haven't really heard that much about that, but I have heard a consistent effort to reach out to different minority groups. You know, in Washington, D.C., where the Republican Party has its headquarters base, I've met, you know, there's an African-American outreach director, a Hispanic outreach director, an Asian American outreach director, and people are working in different battleground states across the country where some of those demographics could be key. You know, think Nevada or Virginia. And they've been setting up operations there, sort of trying to get a better lay of the land, canvassing neighborhoods, going to community cultural festivals. And a lot of this outreach stemmed from the results of the 2012 defeat.
Well, here's a comment from Kyle on Facebook, and I wanted to get this in because this goes to a kind of a question I wanted to ask next. Here's what Kyle writes. I am incredibly white, have never voted for a Republican in my entire life. I'm a working-class, union-supporting Democrat and have been my entire life. Kyle represents the kind of voter that used to be pretty reliable for the Democratic Party. How has that changed over time?
So I think, you know, that's great to hear from you, Kyle. I mean, I think that there are people who are, you know, as you mentioned, union workers who identify with the Democratic Party who are white working class voters. And as you suggested, people, I think, for many years associated people of that sort, that demographic, with the Democratic Party. Where we started to see that transition was about 1980 with Ronald Reagan, you know, where we sort of hear about these Reagan Democrats that the party attracted. And in this election cycle, I will say I have met people at a number of Republican events who say that they identify with the Democratic Party, who told me that they lean Democrat, but sort of no longer feel like they have a home within the Democratic Party. I think that this election cycle, in many ways, may sort of lead to a realignment of how different people feel that they have a home or don't have a home within a particular party. You know, I don't know sort of the answer to that question because I think it's yet to be determined fully. I think that we have seen some polling that suggests that about a quarter of Democrats who say that they're already aligned with a particular party. I saw some polling that suggested both in Ohio and Pennsylvania that about a quarter of those who say that they have decided who they're going to vote for amongst white working class voters, they say that they're behind Donald Trump. And, you know, yes, we sort of always have people who identify with one party but end up voting across the aisles. And so I don't know if this is something that will be a long-term consequence of this election or just sort of, you know, a bump along the road at this point.
Sure. Let's take a call here. We'll go Madison first. And Phil is on the phone with us. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, good afternoon. I think I got into this program just a little bit late, but I thought your guest, she was mentioning who was voting for Trump, and I wanted to question, did you say that the white educated people are voting for Trump or more leaning toward Trump? Because I find that really very hard to believe that anybody would be educated that would vote for Trump. So could you clarify that again for me?
Sure, Phil. Hi, this is Asma. I'm happy to clarify that. So I was saying that I spend a lot of time in New Hampshire, and that's actually where I'm speaking to you all from right now. And here in New Hampshire, Donald Trump has a fairly wide cross-section of support. And so when you look at where he's pulling his support from, overwhelmingly he's doing very well among white, non-college-educated voters. But he is pulling a good chunk of support amongst those also with a college degree. And so it's at least in the case of New Hampshire, I can say he does well with various demographic groups.
And is that comparing him to other Republican candidates
correct.
Or the field
that is
overall?
Yes, so that is comparing him with other Republican candidates. What I can say is that in some of the polling I've seen where he may, say, do better than all of his Republican opponents by double-digit margins amongst white non-college voters, he doesn't have that sort of wide lead amongst college-educated Republicans.
Okay. The data shows that that those with higher education support Democrats. Why do you think that is?
So that's really interesting, John. That is something that we actually pointed out in the story as well, that the idea that postgraduates favored Obama in 2012. I don't know. That's sort of a question of is it the chicken or the egg? You know, are those folks who are going into postgraduate degrees more likely to sort of have an affinity towards the Democratic Party or vice versa? I mean, I don't really know the answer to that. I think what's interesting to me is that the divide comes very clearly at the postgraduate level. So we looked at voters with a high school degree or less, voters who had some college, as well as voters who were college graduates. And at least in the case of 2012, amongst white voters who had high school, some college, or college grads, all of them went pretty solidly for Mitt Romney. The only group of white voters within this educational anatomy that went for President Barack Obama were those with a post-grad degree. And they didn't go for him by huge margins, but the difference was that it was quite a big difference between those who actually opted for the president versus those, you know, who went for Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about minority voters for just a moment. Which Republican presidential candidate do you think has the best chance of recruiting minority voters in the fall?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, I think that we've seen a number of candidates make appeals to various minority groups. Again, I'm speaking sort of about New Hampshire because that's where I've been the last week or so. And I would say Governor Kasich of Ohio was asked sort of a similar question from a candidate from a voter here in the crowd. I think it was at a town hall last week who referenced the fact that he did very well in the gubernatorial race in Ohio amongst African-American voters and that was something that she saw as a solid track record in terms of possibly supporting him for the nomination here in New Hampshire. I've also been in Iowa where there have been efforts to try to bring more Latinos who are sort of increasing in terms of numbers in Iowa in terms of bringing them in participation in the Iowa caucuses. And I was at a mock caucus a few weeks ago where there were different staff members from the campaigns who had sent people in to try to, you know, offer some bits of advice or sort of teach people a little bit about their various platforms. And Jeb Bush was the only Republican candidate at that event who had actually sent a staff member. I think that Jeb Bush has repeatedly made appeals to try to reach out to the Latino community, but I think a lot of this depends on geography. I mean, again, remember the first two nominating states are overwhelmingly white. And so when we talk about minority voters, I think a lot of this depends on what states we're looking at and how far along we get into the nominating calendar.
Well, as you mentioned, you're in New Hampshire right now. Give us the latest from New Hampshire. I mean, is this primary kind of a done deal? Is Trump just going to run away with it on the Republican side? And we haven't really even talked very much about the Democrats when it comes to New Hampshire, at all. Let's talk about the Republicans first. Is this primary essentially over, or does somebody still have a shot here?
So, no, I don't think that New Hampshire's primary is by any means all over. I think you might be referencing the fact that most of the polls we see suggest that Donald Trump has a fairly sizable, considerable lead here in New Hampshire, and pretty much every poll, I want to say since July, has suggested similar results. I think the thing that makes New Hampshire a little bit unpredictable is that New Hampshire has very high turnout. You know, you think about the Iowa caucuses, and the caucuses that, you know, as much attention as we journalists pay to them, they don't really have large voter turnout in that. Here in New Hampshire, it's very different. You know, it's a very sort of simple process. If you're an undeclared voter, you can actually participate in same-day registration. And so because of that and because it's sort of an easy, simple primary system where you go up, show up, you know, fill your ballot out and go on your way, it allows for much greater voter turnout. And because of that, I think it, to some degree, makes the polls and the pollsters' job a little bit more difficult. And so, no, I don't think it's a done deal. I think, though, that many folks have said that, yes, Trump does have a sizable lead, and so could all the polls be wrong up until this point? You know, who knows? I think beyond that, though, I've spoken to various campaigns have suggested that, you know, they really want to win New Hampshire, but winning New Hampshire means different things. That you can sort of win New Hampshire without actually coming in first place. And so I know that Governor Kasich, the governor of Ohio, his campaign has made that argument, that there are certain candidates that they want to beat here in New Hampshire. And if they beat those certain candidates, which they didn't name, but I would presume our, you know, former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, Senator Marco Rubio, and the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, that those are the candidates all trying to be the establishment candidate, and they're trying to win that establishment lane. And whoever comes out of it winning here in New Hampshire, for them, I think that they would see it as a win. You know, they were able to sort of make a mark amongst the competition within that lane.
Well, historically, no one has, in recent history, has been able to become the president without winning either Iowa or New Hampshire. So, you know, there's that. But then everything we've seen in this election cycle anyway seems to be counterintuitive. So who knows what's going to happen? What about on the Democratic side? That Bernie Sanders, the presumptive winner there already, he's doing very well in the polls. What does Hillary Clinton need to come out of New Hampshire with, do you think?
You're right. I think that Bernie Sanders has been doing well in the polls here in New Hampshire, but I wouldn't really discount, you know, the former Secretary of State. I think that she sort of came from behind and had a surprise win in New Hampshire in 2008 against now President Barack Obama. But I think that, you know, she has an extremely well-oiled machine that she's been able, and she's been organizing voters, that her campaign has been organizing voters for months. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about this in Iowa in terms of turnout and what that will mean. I think that's, you know, sort of to the same degree here. I mean, there are certainly advantages that Senator Sanders has here in New Hampshire. Vermont borders New Hampshire. There are places of New Hampshire where you can actually, you know, see Vermont, or that the television stations, say, overlap with one another. And so I think that that is an inherent advantage he has here in New Hampshire, is that he is not an unknown name. He sort of had name recognition from the early on stage, outset of this campaign. But in terms of, you know, what Secretary Clinton needs to do, I think that she needs to have a solid showing here in New Hampshire. And, you know, I think a lot of people have been focusing on the fact that really Secretary Clinton, you know, sort of needs a win either Iowa or New Hampshire. But in terms of New Hampshire, I think that her campaign and sort of analysts writ large have been setting expectations a little bit lower here in New Hampshire and suggesting that Senator Sanders has a bit of a built-in advantage being the senator from next door.
And so if he doesn't win big, he actually has more to lose, I think, is the way they're trying to position that.
That's right. That is exactly right. But, you know, he has this built-in advantage. And so if he doesn't win by huge margins, then maybe that's not necessarily as big of a loss, you could say, for Secretary Clinton. So, you know, it's exactly this idea that there are, quote, many ways to win the state of New Hampshire without actually winning, is what you hear from many campaigns here.
Yeah, the definition of winning keeps changing, and that's one of the things that makes it fun to talk about politics. Asma, I know you have to go. You've got other commitments there, and obviously there's a lot going on in New Hampshire, and NPR is all over it. So we really appreciate your time with us on the Ideas Network, and thank you so much for being here today.
No problem. It was my pleasure. Take care.
Asma Khalid is a reporter for National Public Radio, and we thank her for being here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Derek Wallbank will join me. He is with the Washington Breaking News Desk for Bloomberg News, and we'll continue our political discussion on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Here's the number to call if you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The question under discussion is the Republican reliance on white working class voters kind of a trap for them in a national election? What do you think? 800-642-1234. You can also reach out to us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about the demographics of the Republican voting base. And the genesis for this discussion was an NPR story. The headline, Republicans' White Working Class Trap, a Growing Reliance. We had the reporter who reported that story, Asma Khalid, on with us earlier in the hour. Now joining us is Derek Wallbank, who is on the Washington Breaking News Desk for Bloomberg News. And Derek, thanks for joining us this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So what we've been talking about this hour is there's been a shift over time in the demographics of the voting public. At one time, it was largely white, largely not college educated. The voting population in 2012 we saw looked quite a bit different, and it's probably different still in 2016. Since Ronald Reagan, the Republican formula for winning the White House has rested largely on white working class voters. Is that a winning formula going forward, do you think?
You know, it's one of the things that we've seen a lot of campaigns try and capture, is that sort of white working class, maybe union, maybe not, kind of those Reagan Democrats that you think of. Two people who have done a whole lot of that, Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, has had a tremendous amount of success trying to get some of those voters. We actually see that voting block making up a sizable portion of Donald Trump's electorate.
Yeah, and that's a perspective that's been shared in a number of news reports, and it's kind of an interesting one because it seems a little bit counterintuitive on its face. Is it because both of these guys represent kind of an outside Washington is broken, I'm going to fix it kind of perspective, or why do you think they're both? They're both being received fairly well with that particular demo.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I spent a lot of years reporting in Michigan, and one of the things that I found when I was there was that there was a disconnect among people who liked to vote Republican, depending on how they were affected by trade deals. You would find some people in the sort of Chamber of Commerce wing of a Republican Party, whoever you'd start thinking of that, you know, your executives, your small business owners, people who focused on trade, people who had export businesses, things of that nature, who were very, very seriously happy about things like NAFTA and CAFTA and other such agreements. They've been pushing for a TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal with Asia. They've been pushing for similar deals with Europe. On the flip side of that, you had guys on the union line, maybe some more working class folks, who are sitting there looking at NAFTA and going, boy, there were a lot of car factories that opened up in Mexico that after that deal, and we don't feel like we won off of that. You look at the big husks of old industrial plants that haven't been managed to be solved into whatever is in this new economy, and they feel sort of left out about that. A guy like Donald Trump channels that anger. A guy like Donald Trump walks up and says, you know, we're not going to do bad deals anymore. They say, we're only going to do good deals. Well, you know what? If you lost your job and you think that was a bad deal and someone says the only deal I'm going to do is a good deal, that's kind of a receptive message, right?
Well, it does certainly seem that way on the surface, and that's been one of the criticisms of the Trump campaign is that that's exactly what it is. What about Bernie Sanders, though? Because his message is it's the banks, and we're going to break them all up, and you've been getting a bad deal because, you know, the definition of banker is someone who'll take away your umbrella when it's raining. I mean, that seems to be the Bernie Sanders message. Does that resonate in a similar way to what Donald Trump is saying?
It resonates in a similar way in that it evokes the same sort of feeling. Again, you sort of look to a voter who feels that maybe they've been a little bit taken advantage of in some form. Maybe your house lost a lot of value and it hasn't brought it back, and somebody's telling you that, you know, there were problems with mortgages that came on and that raced up the price of real estate, and you bought in and because, you know, that's the American dream, and it didn't work out, or there was some other problem in the 2008-09 recession, and you were greatly affected by it. And Bernie Sanders is out there saying, "Look, there's, you know, the game is rigged against you." And again, you're channeling into this very much this working class thing, and it's interesting because you talk to Trump and Sanders and their campaigns, and they will tell you very openly that they feel like in a some sense they're fighting for some of the same voters. That you can actually go and meet a voter here in Iowa or in New Hampshire who feels like they're a little bit torn, especially in New Hampshire where there's an open primary, and you'll get some of these guys saying, boy, I'm not sure which primary I'm going to go to, but maybe I'll go vote for Trump, maybe I'll go vote for Sanders. It's the same sort of emotion that's playing there. It's the same, it's kind of a similar logic if you think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a call from Ray in Milwaukee, because I think he speaks to some of the things that you've just been talking about, Derek. Ray, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad you just brought up this point, because this is exactly what I want to speak to, and it's rather complicated. So let me start with my voting history. I've always voted Democratic. I'm a union member. I'm going to be 55 this year. I'm a white male. I don't even have a high school education. But Barack Obama's presidency has been an absolute disaster for union members across this country, and especially here in Wisconsin. And let me explain this. When he decided to jam through Obamacare without a single Republican vote and make it stand, he gave the go-ahead green light to Scott Walker here in Wisconsin and his cohorts to do the same on the other side. And my heart wants to vote Green Party this year, but I know Jill Stein or Steiner, whatever her last name is, I'm not positive, that would be a throwaway vote. And Bernie Sanders will not be allowed to get the Democratic nomination because the Democratic machine is as rotten as the Republican machine. And the reason that Donald Trump seems palatable to us is that he actually seems like a true outsider, beholden to nobody. He might be running in the Republican primaries, but he truly has the Republicans terrified, and I don't like his bullying style. I don't like his style personally, but I do believe when he talks about China that he is right on with everything he has said about our relationships with China, a country that murdered their own citizens when they put up the Statue of Liberty in Tiananmen Square not long after we gave them most favored trade status or whatever. I mean, are we blind to what's going on? And Donald Trump, believe it or not, if you like him or don't like him, if he were to become president, we would see something change, and we have seen nothing change from Bush to Obama. It's all screw the workers. The workers, you know, they're a dime a dozen. Fire them all. And Hillary Clinton's past with the pro Iraq war vote, she voted to bail out the banks. She seems absolutely dishonest and part of the machine, and the machine on both sides is what people are going against.
Okay. Ray, thanks for that call. Derek Wallbank, Ray, I think, describes exactly what you were talking about just a moment ago in terms of the parallel appeal of both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, and I appreciate Ray's point. You know, I think one of the things that I hear a lot from some voters who tend to go Democratic, but let's say are not dyed-in-the-wool Democrats, is that they don't like the divisiveness that has come along with the Obama presidency. And they don't necessarily entirely blame Obama for it. Some of them do. But a lot of them don't blame Obama entirely for it. But even if they hold Republicans partly or mostly responsible for it, they still say, you know, I'd like less of that. And it's interesting. It's interesting when you consider Trump and the absolute outsider case, because that's the thing that Trump and Sanders have in common here, is they're both running as absolute abject outsiders. And you know, one of the interesting things I think about this is that people will walk around and say this is completely unprecedented. On a national scale, maybe. But we have seen before in U.S. politics examples of where complete outsiders walk into a race in a muddled field and emerge victorious. California, it happened with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Minnesota, it happened with Jesse Ventura. It has happened before on a state level. And so I think this is one of those things where, you know, there is a little bit of a playbook to draw from, although you've got to say, who's run it better than Trump?
Well, and it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, people have said, "Well, when the national media gets done with Donald Trump, you know, he'll be running home with his tail between his legs." He doesn't seem to really. He gets angry when people say bad things about him, and he has Twitter wars and all of this and the other thing. But nothing seems to really affect him.
It is a bit of an insulated thing, and one of the things I think has been there's been a constant refrain about this, and we wrote about this a little bit ago. Yesterday, I believe it was, where it said, you know, do you remember back when Donald Trump was supposed to have faded by the end of summer? Well, there's a blizzard warning here in Des Moines for tomorrow. It's caucus day. Guess who's in first?
Okay.
Now, you know, we'll see if those supporters show up to the polls, but it's very clear that whatever fade we all got promised didn't happen. Now, there is another set of that, you know, possible conventional wisdom that says when voters start going to the polls, maybe Trump wins somewhere, and then people go, oh, my goodness, now this actually could happen. We'll take another look at it. I mean, I guess, but a lot of people would have lost a lot of money predicting a Trump fade already.
Well, and your point is well taken. I mean, now people are actually going to be going and pulling a lever or going to a caucus and expressing a preference. You're in Iowa. You've been covering the Iowa caucus. What's your perception of the Trump ground game there? As long as you're there, he's leading in the polls. But what's your perception of his ability organizationally to actually get his supporters to go to a caucus and indicate their preference?
Well, I will disclose by saying that I definitely flew into Iowa, and the last time I was here was 4 years ago. So this is not like coming from a giant Iowa expert, but I do rely on other people who are. David Yepsen, who spent more than 35 years at the Des Moines Register, said the other day, Trump's ground game is better than most people think. When I talk to Iowans on the ground, when I talk to people, you know, who have been contacted by, when I talk to Iowa experts here, they all pretty much say that that Ted Cruz has the best ground game that's going in the state right now. And in fact, one of the things that people are bullying Cruz above his poll numbers is they're saying that vaunted turnout game is probably going to come home here. But the Trump campaign has shown an ability to play by a different set of rules so far. And one of the questions that people have had in this caucus thing is whether a campaign like that will work. It's a very, very different campaign than people have been running. I talked with Joni Ernst this morning. She said very much the same thing. This is not the campaign that people are used to. And one of the things that I think everybody, Senator Ernst included, told Bloomberg this morning, that she's interested to see how it works out too. I think that's one of the big questions is whether or not you can run a campaign like he has run here in a state where everyone has talked about retail politics and meeting somebody five times. Can you really run a race like Trump has run and win? This is going to be a big test, and there's a lot of people, I think, who won't believe that you can until they see it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we may find out that conventional wisdom is not always conventional nor wise. We'll just have to wait for the results. Right now, what we need to do is take a quick break. When we come back, we have some callers who want to join us. Plenty of room for you if you want to call right now, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Leave a comment on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We're talking with Derek Wallbank, who is on the Washington Breaking News Desk for Bloomberg News. He's in Des Moines. He's covering the Iowa caucus for Bloomberg. Just a reminder, WPR will have coverage of the Iowa caucus tonight starting at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're continuing our political discussion that we actually started at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Of course, it's all things political focused on Iowa today because it's the Iowa caucus, the event that kind of kicks off the official part of what is now the endless presidential campaign cycle. And this hour, we've been focused a little bit, or we at least started out focused on the demographic of the core of Republican support, and we've migrated a little bit, but I think in a really interesting way. Derek Wallbank is with me in this part of the program, Washington Breaking News Desk for Bloomberg News. He's in Des Moines covering the caucus. We have some callers who want to join us. Let's go to Madison, and John is on the phone. John, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much and for taking the time. And I don't want to take up too much of your time. I guess I just find myself in a really weird situation. I feel like probably a lot of listeners will identify with what I'm going to say. But number one, I think it's weird that Iowa is sort of like acting as this litmus for the rest of the nation. It's just almost laughable that there's this much hype around Iowa. Number two, I guess I'm a left-leaning, moderate, 30-something-year-old, white-collar, white, maybe upper-middle-class income bracket for being single. I just don't know who to vote for. I mean, I have serious reservations within the party, the Democratic Party, which I usually vote for, with Hillary Clinton's involvement with Walmart and being a Barry Goldwater supporter, and suddenly all Democrats and working class and poor people are supposed to identify with her. And then there's the idea that Bernie Sanders won't get anywhere nationally, and his platform is too extreme, and he's not a real Democrat. And you look at the other side of the aisle where I can't identify with anybody over there. And yes, maybe it's refreshing somebody like Donald Trump says what he means and he's not beholden to anybody. But the vitriol with which he rallies up this fraction of the nation is also really disheartening. And that kind of vitriol is what gets people motivated to be active in politics. I just find myself really disheartened and disappointed this year. And I don't know who I'll vote for or if I'll vote at all. So I guess with that, I can take any response off the air.
Sure, John. And thanks to you for calling and sharing your insights with us this afternoon. Derek Wallbank, what do you take away from John's comments there?
Well, I can appreciate why somebody who lives in the shadow of Camp Randall Stadium wouldn't think that the Hawkeyes should be in charge of anything. I understand that sentiment. I'm a Michigan State guy myself, and it baffles me too. But look, I think he brings up a really excellent point, which is that one of the things that we see a lot of times is, you know, people rely on this demographic stuff. And he described himself as somebody who sort of leans Democratic, right? Well, you can't count on that right now. One of the big curiosities, I guess, of this campaign that we'll get answers to in the next couple of months, at least on the primary side, is that we're seeing a couple of candidates who really come a different way, right? Ted Cruz is your prototypical religious conservative appealing guy, right? And Marco Rubio is starting to get some of the people who are a little bit more on the Chamber of Commerce side, some people like that, although his voting record is not, you know, where the establishment, quote unquote, would have put. But right, you can sort of see some of these campaigns that you see a lot. A guy like Donald Trump is coming out of, you know, a complete other area, sort of candidacy that you don't see much. A guy like Bernie Sanders, I mean, when was the last time that you had a real guy who's running out of, like, you cannot go to the left of me, in a real way, and playing really well in the heartland? You know, these campaigns sort of defy the normal demographic boxes that people put them in a little bit. There are some themes that you can see, that you can trace by, but it's scrambled it a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's one of the interesting things. One of the fascinating things to me, return to the conversation I had with Senator Ernst this morning. So one of her friends, and she didn't tip which way she was going. We asked, believe me. But one of the things she said was she has a friend of hers who's trying to decide between two people. I'm not sure who they're going to vote for. They know they're going to caucus. Who are they between? Rand Paul and John Kasich. Why? I don't know. Those guys aren't, they're not in the same box. You know, you put like, the people like to, there's this narrative that Kasich's in a box with sort of like Jeb Bush and Chris Christie and Marco Rubio, and this is like one lane. But why wouldn't you be choosing between two or three people in that box? Why would you be going over into more of a libertarian box with Paul? I mean, this is the thing. It's not set up neatly. And a lot of times I think you want to be able to put something in a real neat little package and tie it up with a bow and be able to say, in hindsight, this is exactly why this happened. Mm-hmm. I think this campaign so far is kind of defying that.
Well, full employment for reporters anyway. Let's take a call from Caroline in Chippewa County. Carolyn, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I just, we're at the president, and everybody wants to vote to be the president. But a couple of things to remember is Congress controls a lot of things. So if Obama does something on his own, they say he's bad. If he goes to Congress for help, it's like no one has any common sense on that part. When he was first elected, the Tea Party's goal was to make him look bad. So we need reporters that objectively tell the truth. When Hillary was working for Goldwater, she was in high school. In high school, we often do things that our parents guide us into. Once we get older, we learn a little bit, and we are independent thinkers a little bit better. So, but people are so busy working right now, it's hard to really keep up with what is the truth and what lies are people allowed to say and not be corrected, I guess.
Carolyn, thanks for that perspective. Her point about, we're talking a lot about the president because we're in a presidential election cycle, but, how does this play out? What happens if Trump becomes the nominee of the Republican Party? What happens with all those congressional races?
Well, it's really interesting, too, because you all have, a young guy from Janesville and Paul Ryan, who's Speaker of the House, and he right now is sort of the policy-focused face of the Republican Party because you don't have a nominee right now. Ryan has come out and said multiple times that he wants Republicans in Congress to present an actual alternative for people to vote for. He's trying to get this book of proposals, I guess you'd say, in place so that you can say the GOP is not just against something, they're for this. The difficulty of that is best expressed by the Republican reaction to Obamacare. No Republicans voted for it in Congress, as the caller rightly said, but articulating an alternative to it has been a little bit difficult. There was a resolution that passed on that was adopted in the House one of the very first days after Republicans took control in 2011. It said a couple of committees will go to the table and we'll draft an alternative and we'll present it and vote on it. That's it. It's been years. It's never happened. Yeah. Those hearings didn't happen. The votes didn't happen. And we're told that there are plans on the table. There are things people have done, but no one's ever, as an entire party, sort of coalesced around an entire thing, aside from a few framework points on like buying insurance across state lines, some tort reforms and things like that. And it sort of shows the difficulty with that.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be a continuing thing because, as the caller rightly pointed out, whoever gets elected has to work with Congress. This is actually something, if I can bring this up, that Bernie Sanders is trying to do to blunt Hillary Clinton's attacks, because Hillary Clinton is making the case. She's all over Iowa TV right now. And her negative ads, and the negative ads being run in her stead, are saying that Sanders has great ideas, but we can't afford to wait for this pie-in-the-sky stuff to pan out. And Bernie is contracting that by saying, I have a record when I was the top Democrat on the Veterans Affairs Committee. We did this, and I've worked with John McCain, and I've worked with Jeff Miller of Florida, and all of these other people. And so you actually see on the Democratic side a campaign about who can actually be viable. On the Republican side, I think it would be a joy of joys for reporters to try and figure out how Ted Cruz or Trump would work with Congress.
Here's a thought that comes from Paul in an email. It might be a good one to close with, besides which we're almost out of time. Paul writes, if Reagan was the Teflon president, nothing stuck to him. Perhaps Trump is ceramic. So far, he is withstanding a level of controversy that would have left Reagan smoking. Is Trump the ceramic candidate?
I think Donald Trump has been able to shield himself from attacks in ways that certainly nobody has thought he would be able to do. The number of times we have heard someone sit there and say, oh, this is definitely the thing that's going to get him. You remember back when he had a go at John McCain?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone said that I was disqualifying. How many months ago was that? Look where he is now.
Yeah.
This is one of the things. Like, rumors of his death have been greatly exaggerated.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll see how it all works tonight.
Okay. Derek Wallbank, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Have a great one.
Derek Wallbank is on the Washington Breaking News Desk for Bloomberg News. We heard earlier from Asma Khalid with National Public Radio. Thanks so much to Scott Myers for producing this hour of programming, KP Whaley for handling on-air production, and technical support from the always reliable Dave Potratz. John Munson in for Kathleen Donnell. We'll be back tomorrow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.